Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books Network South Asian Studies. We are here today with Sushmita Pathy. Sushmita is Assistant Professor of Political Science at the National Law School of India University, Bangalore. She studied political science at Delhi University and Jawaharlal Nehru University. She is interested in studying the intersections of urban politics and political economy. Her recent book, which we are going to talk about today, Properties of Rent, Community, Capital, and Politics in Globalizing Delhi, is now out from Cambridge University Press. Sushmita, welcome to the show and thank you so much for coming.
Thank you, Sharunik, for having me.
Thank you. Let me just ask you my very first question, which is, before we kind of dive into your scholarship, I'm so excited to talk about Delhi with you. And, you know, I went to JNU like you. I said, lived there for 5 years and then I've never, you know, loved the city more. So let me ask you a personal question, which is, why did you decide to work on Delhi in the first place? And, you know, and I guess a subset of this question, how did rent become the object of your study?
So there's no one reason for having taken up Delhi as my field of study. I also, quite like you, I came to the city pretty early, as in at the age of 18, to study. And as in a big part of negotiating with, your own freedoms, your becoming an adult, finding your place in the world, was about negotiating the space in the city. So I quite associate my own growth or my own understanding with the city itself. So, this is a controversial point, but precisely like you said, you never love a city more if you've spent a significant part of your youth in Delhi. But it's also so fascinating. You meet the most interesting of people. You have the most bizarre experiences in the city, which makes you think so much more about the place, its people, and what it means. So that's the reason why Delhi as a city, and I thought, as in when it came to choosing a research topic, I couldn't come up with anything else but the city. So I grew up in a planned township in a small town in Jharkhand. So when I came to Delhi, I was quite fascinated with the buildings, with the Lutyens, and these big places and big and small all kinds of spaces in Delhi. So my first work was, which is for my MPhil dissertation, was around the statues of the colonial administrators that were left behind. And part of it was also on Latin's Delhi and how that had to transform after India gains independence. and some part of it had to deal with, again, these big temples coming up. Why is it that you suddenly have these big temples dotting the landscape, like Akshardham and a Hanuman statue somewhere? So what does it mean for a city, and especially in its post-2000 form? Right. So those were the questions that interested me immediately, which are questions of public history. But by my PhD, I had moved on to looking at urban forms. This was actually my supervisor's idea, saying that why don't you look at this? In fact, nobody has written on it, and nobody really had. So I thought, yeah, this is interesting. But I went in pretty blind. I wasn't quite sure what I was looking at. I knew I'm interested in this contradiction, like what are these urban villages, you know, these, what is so urban about them and what is so village about them, right? What is it that, you know, fundamentally makes a city and a village a village? Are these just purely aesthetic distinctions that we make? You know, village needs to have a bullock cart, or a village cannot have a dish antenna TV. So are those the kind of distinctions we make between a village and a city? Because that's when we see that, you know, those distinctions sort of, even heuristically, if you have to make them, they sort of break down. Like a village can be a village where, you know, you don't have any of these, but and a city can have all of these, and can have a bullock cart, can have, you know, a cattle around and still be a city, right? So then what is it that we are really looking at in terms of a village and a city? So those were the questions that were immediately of interest to me. Rent is something that became more important to me much later. It's only towards the end of my fieldwork that I began fiddling with rent as a conceptual category, and more or less, and moreover, as what I'm calling a social life of rent. So that began to become more and more important to me towards the latter half. So much of what I write about rent as an analytic, it develops as my post-PhD work. It's there in snatches in my PhD, but in quite a substantial manner, it develops much later.
Yeah, I was just having a vision of Oscar's village in present Delhi. The class connotations of the word village is very different.
And precisely these are questions that, that's what my argument is, and that's what I find so alluring about the concept of rent. These are precisely the questions that somehow capital as an analytic category has not been able to answer, because it looks at the question of urban transformation as either one of dispossession, that capital comes in and dispossesses people further and further, or it looks at it through the aspect of gentrification, that a village becomes a place like gets dispossessed and then slowly becomes into an urban form, right? You know, a building comes up in place of a farm. So that's the kind of literature that we have seen. But it's precisely these places like a Hozkaz, which is not a transient kind of a form. It's here to stay. And these are these in-between spaces which have a very different story to tell, which is not one of dispossession, which is also not of gentrification, but that only explains only so much. That's why I think rent could be useful in explaining some of these gaps in the urban studies scholarship.
That's fascinating, because it really, our listeners will read the book, but it's wonderful how you kind of maintain the thread of that analytic. But in your first chapter, you talk about historical origins of this, you know, economic landscape, and you map the changing geography of the city over decades based on land acquisition and the location of that land and the time of its acquisition. So can I ask you to give us a brief overview of this process, which is very complex, of course?
Oh, of course. So this is since this is the first chapter, I start from the time of land acquisition itself, which is 1950s. And as we all know, 1950s is a fairly interesting period in Delhi's history, in Delhi's life, because this is right after independence, when partition has taken place. There's a huge influx of migrants who are coming in. Delhi is suddenly the capital of a post-colonial state, which has to then expand and grow. So as a result, there is, in order to make this space, you know, for this new capital city, what begins to happen is of course land acquisition. So this is probably one of the biggest land acquisition that ever took place. It's around 34,000 acres of land, which lied outside of on the southern fringes of the city, begins to get acquired by the state. Right. And this is what we today know as quote unquote South Delhi. This is probably the most expensive, the most let's say posh localities of Delhi. The most expensive restaurants and hotels are all around South Delhi. But this is also in a way a reflection of what the Nehruvian post-colonial city was supposed to be like, right? It was supposed to have these nice residential localities, which is supposed to be made by the Delhi Development Authority. It was supposed to have these nice middle-class shopping complexes, big wide roads, and of course, most importantly, institutions, right? So it's not really a circumstance. It's not really a coincidence that IIT and JNU and these big institutions with a lot of land begin to come up around South Delhi. And in many ways, if you look at it, the story of land crunch, you know, the shortage of land, is also related to this the story of these big institutions coming up and then getting so much land, right? So so that's what I'm looking at. And much of these institutions, these colonies, these complexes are all built on these erstwhile village agricultural land. So what I'm trying to tell in this book is this shadow of the modern city. So what's happening behind the scenes, right? So so I'm looking at this transition of these village lands and village agricultural lands into urban modern city kind of urbanization, right? So when I'm looking at land acquisition, I see that there are two things which become important. One is, of course, the question of time, and the other is that of location. So between the question of between the time when land is notified to the time that the land is actually taken up for development, there is a significant time gap. Right. So as a result, what happens is that the moment this news of notification reaches people, right, they begin to speculate on land. They begin to all kinds of developments begin to crop up for various kinds of complicated reasons. Right. So as a result, when the state finally arrives to develop that land is already built. Right. It's already developed into a market, into residential colonies, into so many more things. And this is the story of unauthorized colonies of Delhi for the most part, right? This is one land gets notified, it's just indiscriminately built on, and then what you see is the story of unauthorized colonies. So in a way, the slow bureaucratic process is met with this very fast kind of speculative activity that is done by people, right? And that's where this tension really lies. The other question of time is also one of the time of acquisition. So in a village that I study, the acquisition itself was stretched over two decades. So people's fates depended on sheer luck, on when the land was actually acquired. Right, so if your land got acquired in the 1950s, then you got a pittance for it. But if your land got acquired later, then you probably were able to negotiate much better with the state. So those kinds of unevenness in the process really made a difference to individual a story of land acquisition. The same happens with location as well, right? So with rural land, land intrinsically can carry value, right? So depending on the quality of land, whether it's irrigated or not, right? There is a certain kind of quality of land on which you can base the price of the land. But when it comes to urban land, intrinsic value doesn't matter. What matters is what's outside it, right? So is there a big road crossing by, passing by your land? So then your land has more value, right? If is there a shopping complex next door? So then your land, you can claim higher value for your land. So then what happens so what I'm seeing in these historical land acquisition documents is there is this complete let's say amnesia. I wouldn't say amnesia. I would say there's a complete negation of the fact that actually speculation is happening, that this is not rural land you're talking about, right? Much of it's built. But then land acquisition documents are constantly saying, oh, no, this is, you know, rural land and this is the quality of land, so therefore we will only value it this much. And the people are contesting it. People are saying that, no, this isn't just rural land, you know, so and then you see courts step in and then all kinds of negotiations around what is really the value of the land, right? So that's why I'm saying that the question of time and location both become important in sort of determining individual fates of people. So in many ways, land acquisition is often seen as this event, right? Like it happens once, it strikes like lightning, and then it changes everything. But in my work, I see it as a very long drawn event, which is probably not even an event, right? It's a process almost, right? And has a varying effect on people's lives.
So speaking of that, you know, this protracted process of land acquisition, and so in your next chapter, you look at the residents of the erstwhile residents of these villages, which were swallowed up by the growing city and who received compensation for their acquired land. And so how does this process, as you find, determine the recent histories of these communities?
So like I was alluding before, this isn't a story of complete dispossession, right? So these are the stories, as in the stories of dispossession that we know, of land acquisition that we know of people actually being dispossessed and having resettled and the struggles that they face, right? For some strange reason, the government at this time did not quite adopt that policy. It's not very clear why, but it could be to keep the prices down or to avoid that complication of resettlement. Probably those were the reasons. But the policy that the government adopts is precisely this, that their agricultural land would be acquired, but the residential land of the village, where the villages are, like where the huts and the havelis and these older houses are, it's called the Abadi area in technical terms, that is not going to be disturbed. So as a result, what happens is that the agricultural land is taken away, right? And this is what the negotiations are over. But they're not entirely displaced. So what you see is then agrarian pastoral community, which is the Jats. I'm looking at only Jats, but they could be Gujar villages also, who are now left with no livelihood of their own, but what they have is some amount of compensation money. And what they have to do is to now negotiate with this growing city and try to figure out new kinds of, let's say, livelihoods for themselves. So which is why in the second chapter, I talk about how they're now sort of investing their money in in infrastructure projects, in, say, they're getting into contracting business, they're getting into transport. And much later in post-1990s, you see that, I'm talking about how they become, they begin to invest in housing, which is probably one of the most important kind of, let's say, infrastructure in any city. So that's precisely what I look at. So I look at two villages. One is Munirka and the other is Shapurjad. Both are around 5 kilometers apart from each other. Both of them were acquired in the 1950s, around the same time. But they have different stories, precisely because of the, again, the question of location. Munirka is located right next to the ring road, which becomes an arterial road. So because of its construction, this land, this village becomes commercialized pretty, pretty early. It gets commercialized as early as early 1960s. It markets and everything are beginning to crop up. It's also right opposite R.K. Puram, which is the government colony. It's a huge government, central government colony that comes up right opposite it. So Munirka, in a way, begins to cater to that locality. But on the other hand, Shapurjad, which is acquired at the same time, does not see that kind of development almost immediately, because it's further from any major important roads. So until 1978-79, until it's decided that Asian Games Village will come up close to this on Shapurjad's agricultural land, people are still doing agriculture there, right? So that's the difference. So this place begins to develop very, very differently, right? Shapurjad, for some reason, becomes home to garment artisans, to karigars who work on garments. And it becomes home to these small manufacturing spaces. Right? On the other hand, Munirka becomes a residential space. So migrants who are looking for a place to live begin to, and initially their construction workers were all employed in constructing in the infrastructure around Delhi. They begin to live in these villages. So that's where the differences are. So as a result, what happens is that because Munirka is already developed, it goes in the direction of making spaces for more and more migrants. So post-1990s, there is a strong influx of migrants, a different class of migrants into the city, who are now looking not for manufacturing jobs, they're looking for service jobs, right? So it's BPO workers, it's students like you and me who landed up in the city, it's UPSC aspirants who are landing up in the city. So these villages, at least a village like Munirka, begins to cater to this kind of migrants who cannot afford upper middle class localities in Delhi, but also cannot live in slums. So that becomes the becomes Munirka's kind of rental market. Shapurjad, on the other hand, becomes home to, like I said, some garment craftsmen and manufacturers had already started making this place. By 2000s, these new fashion designers begin to set up workshops because the garment karigars are already there, right? So you have designers like Rohit Bal, who make a big name for themselves in the industry, begin to open up workshops there. And soon what happens is that this begins to be curated into a sort of a niche garment, almost a boutique kind of a market, where all kinds of small designers, even big designers, begin to open up these boutiques for themselves. And soon it becomes very, very popular with the Delhi wedding clientele, right? So if you have a big fat wedding in Delhi, so then this is where you go in order to get your clothes made, right? So you see a very different kind of investment in a place like Shapoorjat, where people are more invested in upgrading their rental properties. They want cobbled stones. They want to put up, you know, street lights and so on and so forth.
So I think in what you said, we have just come up to the time of liberalization, 1990, and you, in your third chapter, you take up the period since liberalization, and you say that a different kind of rental economy arises in this period, and how conventional understandings of neoliberal urbanization might fall short in explaining it. So what does this economy look like?
So I do tell a chronological story in the book. So what I'm trying to say is that by 1990, things begin to change quite rapidly for these villages. So with the move from manufacturing to service, it's, of course, it's an entire shift for an entire country in terms of what the economy is going to be like. But for these villages, what's happening is that until 1990, it's only the outer fringe of these villages which have transformed. The inside of the villages, as the villages are on the inside, they remain quite unchanged and untouched, right? Until 1990s. But post 1990s, what happens is that the village land, because real estate becomes such a big thing post liberalization, that the village land itself becomes speculative. And this period is important for the one crucial reason that the village land, because it was non-revenue earning, it was never mapped on the colonial records. So as a result, the understanding of property itself in these villages was often based on a historical understanding of, oh, this land belongs to this person and this belongs to this person. But the moment village land begins to have value, that understanding entirely breaks. So there's a time when a messy scamper for land actually takes place, where people just grab whatever piece of land they could. So there's a time when a lot of bitter fights begin to take place between neighbors and brothers over land. But in the end, these villages become increasingly cramped with everyone having grabbed whatever piece of land that they could. But to me, the story is also important because this also brings about the nature of this deep sense of collective ownership of land that defines their historical sense of self. And I'm here talking about the Jat communities. It's a longer story about how Jats historically have identified with land ownership, and much work has been done on that, so I won't go into that. And this is what I'm saying is not something capital explains very well. To me, this dogged attachment to land, the sense of ownership, can only be explained through rent, because it's capital which works on the logic of quick selling, buying, and speculating. But rent, on the other hand, depends on this thick notion of collective ownership of the same resource. Like, it could be oil for someone, it's, in this case, it's land here, right? So I trace this complex process by which villagers are being able to suddenly, like, of course, there is a lot of, like I said, there's a lot of bad blood, there is a lot of, you know, feuds which crop up, but eventually it all settles down. And it settles down into a rather, let's say, closely knit sort of a rental market. And to my mind, it almost works like a cartel, right? Where almost every participant owns a bunch of, say, one-room sets or these one-room apartments to rent. And everyone has a commodity which is more or less uniform, right? So if the thing is that there is not a lot of differentiation in this market. More or less all one-room flats here are poorly built, there are water problems, there is not enough ventilation. So as it is, or this roughly the same size. So by and large, they are all the same, right? So in a way, they're able to efficiently able to manage this market in terms of, okay, what would be the going rent for like an average flat? All of this is only possible if you are able to cartelize. And what I say, what I argue, is that the panchayat, which is a village institution, is becomes that platform, becomes that institution, which becomes extremely crucial in order to make that cartelization possible, right? In a place like Shapurjat, you see a different kind of an institution crop up. In Shapurjat, you see how families begin to invest into property together, right? So if you have historically held a piece of land together because of your forefathers and so on, so you begin to invest and upgrade that land together, right? So it almost works like a joint stock company. The only difference is that it's not anonymous. Like an actual joint stock company could be anonymous. It's quick buying and selling. In this, anonymity is not possible. Everybody is a trusted member, and you all have huge stakes in upgrading that property together. So those are the two kind of institutions that I look at. That one, in one form, in Munirka, you see it emerge like a cartel. In Shapurjat, you see families working quite like a vernacular joint stock company. So this is what I'm trying to see as to what is possibly happening through what I'm calling vernacular capitalism.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
In the next chapter, you look at the government and financial institutions that shape the lives of these communities. And you've been talking about that a little bit. But could you give us a kind of brief but a little longer history of how these institutions have worked?
So, so what I was trying to respond to you in your previous question as well, that in this literature on capitalism in India, we've seen a growing interest around the term vernacular capitalism. So we've seen how works on Marwaris, Banyas, Nadars, Gaunders, and how they've made their way into capital. But these stories, however illuminating, are also about how these communities are willingly courting capital and trying to mimic the ways of their northern counterparts. So that's the story you get when you read about the Tatars or, say, the Calcutta Marwaris. But in this case, there is, of course, the story of that kind of courting of capital, but there is also a story of that deep suspicion that these villagers have had for the city and the capital that comes with it. Which is why you see that much of the investment that they make is through hard cash and real estate. So you would not hear of Jats of Delhi mostly making money through stocks or shares. It is money that flows in through hard cash that allows for strict control of who can be a part of this economy and who cannot, right? So opening up themselves up to finance capital would also mean diluting these precise social networks that they have built over generations. And that is something that they don't want, right? So in this chapter, what I do is I look into the nitty-gritties of these supposedly primordial social relationships and how they operate in the neoliberal economy. So which is why, say, the panchayat and the kunba become so very important. The funny thing about panchayat is that in a city like Delhi, they are not recognized as formal bodies, right? Because it's urbanized. It's a municipal corporation that's supposed to be your local body, not a panchayat. But these local informal panchayats, what they have done is that they have sometimes registered themselves as a resident welfare association. But they don't look like anything like a resident welfare association. In their program, this manifesto, they would have things like, "Oh, one should respect their elders. We would help with weddings in families." So it's women are not allowed to vote in until recently in Munirka, women couldn't vote for the RW elections. So in many ways, it continued to work like a caste based panchayat that it used to exist as, right? And I'm saying that this is what is interesting about these institutions. On one hand, they behave like savvy economic institutions which manage rent. But on the other hand, they also retain this very localized cultural understanding of who they are as a community, as people, right? So the question around financial institutions, this part was a very tricky one to research on and to negotiate. Because much of it's so clandestine, you don't know how, and nobody's willing to speak about it. So I could only gather some senses of how these networks really work. But like I was saying before, that investments are often made within trusted networks of people and often hard cash. And so as money begins to flow in, you see two kinds of financial institutions or financial forms actually rather crop up. One is called a committee and the other is called financing, right? And it's interesting why both these words are in English, right? And they don't use a Hindi word for it. So committees are a form of chit funds where 20 people invest an equal amount of money and then that becomes the pool to then borrow money and earn interest from. In a situation where you don't have bank loans, where property is unauthorized, these committees have become interesting and important alternative institutions which do something like what banks would do. Financing, interestingly, on the other hand, is nothing more than an evolved form of money lending. So instead of waiting around for, say, your loan period to get over for you to then claim your principal amount and your interest, what they do is that they fix a monthly installment. So as a result, what happens is that it keeps that chain of money and its circulation far more alive than, say, a regular money lending format would. So this is what they call financing. So there are people who identify, they won't identify to you or to us, but they're called financiers in the village, right? It took me a while to figure out who these financiers are and what does it mean to be a financier. But that's precisely what they do. So what I'm trying to see is that, of course, this is also part of a question of compulsion, you know, and this sort of a fractious relationship between rent and capital. The city and capital see them as with suspicion, and they've had to create these alternative arrangements to trump that. But the other way to look at it is also that maybe these villages also approach the city and capital with as much suspicion. They both have meant opportunities for each other, but at the same time, they're big threats to the city is a big threat to the sense of self, their social fabric, and their economic life. So the only way to trump that is to not get absorbed either into the city or into the networks of capital. Yeah. Mm.
So you talked about, you know, how money moves and how money moves in clandestine ways, and how money moves in, you know, under the aegis of these institutions, how money moves in ways that are not always legible. And the one of, I mean, related to that are the various axes of prejudice and oppression, along which extractive rents move, and they determine the geographic and demographic growth of the city, which is the subject of your fifth chapter. And you use the concept of majburi, or compulsion, in your analysis here. How does that work out?
Thanks, Sharuni, for the question. Chapter 5 is very, very close to my heart because it's precisely this chapter and the fieldwork that I did for it that made me seriously think about rent and what is so different about it. So as I was doing my fieldwork, a case of a rape of a 14-year-old Manipuri girl in Munirka became quite, it flared up quite badly. The rape was committed by the landlord's son, so it became increasing, it became even more controversial. So immediately after that incident, the landlords called a panchayat meeting and they wanted to evict all northeastern tenants. Munirka, since 2000, has emerged as a space where several migrants from all over the northeast came to find a place to live. So you would see, you know, there are now local shops which sell food and vegetables and spices from the northeast. And that's quite common. So they have, over a period of years, built that kind of an ecology around these, especially around a village like Munirka. But as much as this is possible, it's not free of its racial tension. The villagers look down upon the northeastern migrants as immoral, who are polluting their older ways of living. The northeastern tenants also, they speak of frequent harassment at the hands of the landlords. So being vulnerable, they are made to pay higher rents. Sometimes their possessions are not returned back, and so on. And when I was doing my field work, and when this case of rape took place, so this event made me look at this entire racial tension very, very differently, because that's when this palpable sort of a, you know, racial tension, it bursts open into the fore, right? So this standoff, it brought this tension around rent, which revolves so much around people's identities. The fact that these northeastern migrants are racially marked, it leaves them very vulnerable in a housing market where housing is so hard to come across, right? So as a result, what happens is that discrimination in the regular housing market, we all know that, you know, it happens by not giving you a place to live, right? So the way in which Muslims face discrimination, or say single women or queer couple, they face discrimination, is by simply being refused, right? By saying that, okay, this is only a class, only a neighborhood which will only have, say, married people with families and respectable, and so on and so forth, right? But in these places, they don't have the luxury of saying no, right? So eventually what happens is that people who you dislike, right, who you think are polluting your place, right, your community and your culture, are precisely the people who you are bound to be renting out to, right? So as a result, what happens is that creates this strange kind of a racial tension where the landlords speak of majburi or compulsion, right? That, and this is where, you know, the sense of having lost out to the city becomes like a very emotionally charged feeling for the villagers, right? Because they feel that they have sold out to the city, they have lost to greed, and this is why, as in, we are no longer who we used to be. And that's the kind of tension that becomes so, in a way, very generative in terms of rent, right? Because it's precisely this discrimination which and the compulsion on the and the hands of on the side on the part of the northeastern tenants as well, who have no other place to rent out homes from but these places, who are forced to shell out a higher rent, a racial surcharge, precisely for the fact that they they're racially marked, right? So that tension is quite palpable in many of these places. So I speak of these vigilante groups coming up, which start talking about or preserving the culture and providing security, right? You see all kinds of YouTube videos making their way onto the internet, which are again extremely which are violent, of course. But on the other hand, it also it's also sexualized in a very, very different way. So those are the things that I try to hit upon in this chapter.
I remember the time myself, and it's something that even if you are, you know, I mean, you research this, but even if you're not a researcher, you're outside the system, it still, you know, comes through just by living near that place. And then, you know, in the next chapter, you study the upward mobilities of some Dalit communities, which belie conjectures one might make based on the ties between the nature of rent and Jat identities, which is, you know, something that you preface. Could you elaborate a little bit on this?
So there's something I build on from the first chapter onwards. The Jats are crucial to the story around land and speculation precisely because of their historical affinity to land. As a community, they had been recognized as an agrarian caste under the Punjab Land Alienation Act 1900. And what it did was that it forbade the sale of land to any community which which is not agrarian, right? Which they haven't been, which they haven't marked as agrarian, right? So as a result, what happens is that a lot of land in northwest part of India comes into the hands of the Jat community, right? But on the other hand, what happens is that when you look at Dalits, right? Who are mostly landless, they have a very different relationship to land, right? So they're not in this picture, in the story of speculation and, you know, land acquisition happening and people challenging it. They're not in the story until the late 1990s, right? Until the village land begins to become valuable, right? And that's when what happens is that the land for on which, say, the Jatav community, which is a Dalit community, holds have their houses, they also become valuable, right? And interestingly, what happens, it's marked by two things. One is that in any village in India, it has a particular kind of a caste structure, right? So what happens is that mostly the Dalits are placed on the outskirts of a village, right? But what happens is that because of this changing nature of urbanization and capital and all of that, what happens is that it's the fringes of the land, right, which is directly facing the city, they become, those lands become more and more valuable, right? Which traditionally belonged to the Dalits. So this is all. There is also a story of land grabs and displacement of Dalits within this place, right? But at the same time, they still continue to hold some amount, right? Some parts of these lands, and they continue to. And what happens is that then they emerge as landlords, right? The second thing that happens is that by 1990s, the first generation of Dalits, who are strong Ambedkarites amongst the Jatav community, they begin to they got jobs in the 50s and the 60s, and by 1990s they have begun to retire. So their retirement money, their retirement benefits, are now going into creating new kinds of rental property. Right. So this is a way in which the Jatavs emerge as landlord and emerge as an important constituency within the cartel, right? So it's not that this cartel is entirely a closed Jat association. It cannot be. So frequently, the Jatavs collectively assert their position within the cartel and say, there are instances when the dominant community, the Jats, have had to let go and say, okay, and agree to what the Jatavs are arguing for. So those kinds of negotiations are now collectively possible for the Jatavs, who individually may not have a lot of property, but collectively they are quite a sizable section of this people who own these properties within the village. Right? But on the other hand, I also trace the story of another Dalit community, which is the Valmikis. Now, Valmikis are historically the sweeper community who are now into sanitation work. So as a result, they got municipal government jobs in the beginning. But now as these jobs are being more and more contractualized, they are finding themselves increasingly more and more precarious. And because of their precarious position already within the village architecture, they are, unlike the Jatavs who are able to assert themselves, the Valmikis are not able to assert themselves. They haven't been able to become landlords the way Jatavs have, right? So you see that even within Dalits, the story of how rent plays out is not uniform. So different people, different communities are able to maneuver this opportunity very, very differently. So in this, you see Jatavs have been successful to some extent, but the Valmikis have completely lost out.
Finally, you know, the lives of oppressive landlords, the lives of tenants who are running out of choices, the lives of differentially mobile Dalit communities, all of their lives come together, I think, in, as you say, the social life of rent, which kind of enters a spectacular dimension in electoral politics. And in the last chapter, you talk about how the social life of rent depends on electoral politics and how it occasions the movement of monies. So could you give us a brief description of your final chapter?
Thanks, Sharunik. So to me, the electoral scene is a direct corollary to the question of the social life of rent. So post-1990s, we witness how Jats all over Delhi have come up as an important wealthy community owing to the growing value of real estate and speculation and so on and so forth. But much of this money we see is now being redirected into electoral politics. Jats have emerged as a visible community now, more important for the calculations of electoral politics. So there are studies being done, and Jats and Gujjars together, they constitute almost 20% of the total contestants from both Congress and BJP. Right? So that's something that I knew that there is a connection between this newfound aspiration for politics and what's happening on the side of rent. So the way I see it is that this aspiration is an inevitable consequence of an economy that works on rent. Because rent is about collective ownership of an undifferentiated resource, right? And it does not quite allow heroes to emerge. Capital, on the other hand, allows those heroes to emerge, right? You know, you have those rags to riches stories. We have stories of these, you know, risk-taking, very alpha masculine figures who are, dabbling with money. But that's not the case with rent, because the individual is always unimportant than the collectivity. The collectivity is far more important. Your strength is in the fact that you are in this together, right? So the individual actor doesn't matter. But as you're becoming more and more wealthy, those aspirations of social distinction also emerge, right? It's inevitable. So the only way to find it, or at least the dominant way to find it, is by investing in local politics, right? And mostly, which is why it's not municipal corporations or municipal elections that they're interested in. They're interested in the legislative assembly, at least, right? Because to become a counselor is fine, but it still, it doesn't earn you the social distinction. You can become that, earn the social distinction only when you have, at least you are an MLA, right? So which is why you see more and more, and as wards have become smaller, right? This is something also is that it's important. More and more people are finding it possible to now win or at least contest for elections, right? So what I do in this chapter is I follow these different figures. One is, of course, a figure like an aspirational neta, right? A leader who wants to win any ticket, right? It doesn't matter. So they're trying to, just before the election, there's a lot of euphoria around elections and who's courting which party and what's going to happen and who's going to eventually win the elections. There's a lot of talk in these villages. So there are those figures who are constantly trying to, like, you know, weigh their bets in different parties. And interestingly, my fieldwork coincided with two elections which happened quite back-to-back in Delhi, when AAP emerged quite spectacularly as this new, you know, force in electoral politics. So I saw very interesting dynamics around how people saw AAP initially. They didn't see it as any party of any worth. But as the first election, the 2014 election happens and AAP wins it, there is a sudden excitement around getting that AAP party ticket and how people are now really looking at it as something that they would, that people are like literally making a beeline for, right? So all these wealthy sort of people who've done well over in the last decade, you see them all trying to court up and of course BJP for a party ticket. Yeah.
Just for our listeners who might not be familiar, AAP is AAP, the Aam Aadmi Party, which literally translates into the common man's party, I guess. And BJP is Bharatiya Janata Party, which is in power at the center right now. But yeah, sorry for the interruption.
Thanks for doing that, actually. It totally skipped me that I should. There are those aspirational leaders. And along with them, what you see is that there are these bunch of men who don't have enough money to fight elections. But the way in which they try to get in or get their foot to the door is by attaching themselves to one particular leader. So they become their sort of cronies who sort of do their little bit of work, or they at least follow the leader when he's walking through the village or he's trying to go for a campaign. So they're called party karyakartas. So they like calling themselves party workers or karyakartas. But what they're essentially attached to that individual, not necessarily so much to the party always. So what I'm trying to look at is in a way, both the leader as well as the party worker are in a way trying to salvage their sense of social distinction, or call it masculinity, through the election process, right? And the election becomes that field where that victory, or even if it's not a victory, but the presence matters, because that presence itself sets you apart from the others, right? Who are part of the village, right? So that's something that is what I'm trying to tell through this particular chapter.
I guess, you know, I can't let you go without asking you about your future work. So in the book, you end your book with some foresight about the future urbanization of Delhi. So does this signal a new book that, you know, continues the work that you have done in Properties of Rent? And what are you working on now? And what is the next thing that we can expect from you?
I didn't have a conclusion in the book. I had an epilogue, so where I'm talking about, okay, what could rent possibly mean, especially when we are looking at pandemic, right? When this, what I'm talking about is a seller's market, right? Where everything is about it's dominated by the sellers themselves. But what happens when a pandemic hits and suddenly no one wants to live in these places anymore? Most people are going back or have all of that. So I end, because it was written during, I was finishing the book during the second wave. So it still has that kind of unanswered questions, which, and what directions rent may possibly take. But I don't think I am going to do this work after this. I think it's for future. So those were rather questions for maybe future researchers to take these questions up, questions where I haven't gone, and maybe look at rent in a very different setting altogether. And because I do think, I am quite convinced that we need to look more and more into questions of these kinds of social relations, which sometimes capital does skip over. So for me, I think I've saturated myself with this. I think I'm moving on to something else. I'm still toying over what exactly it's going to be, at least my next book project. I have at least three ideas, and I think I like all of them equally, but I think I'll take a while to settle on one. But at this point, I'm actually working on the question of housing rights, and I'm trying to look at why is it that housing rights activism has focused so much on ownership, the question of the fact that you need to have land titles. And I'm trying to make an argument that in doing this, which is a very important cause, but in doing this, what we have done is we have left this humongous vacuum of people who either cannot own land or cannot own property in village, in a city, or do not even aspire to. And I'm talking about, and I'm specifically talking about the migrant workers who we saw the moment lockdown is announced, we see them picking up their stuff and walking to their homes, because the city is not their home. It is never intended to be their home, right? So I think that was the moment when it triggered this thought that I think the housing rights discourse seems to have missed this rather important, I think I'm being a little unfair. I wouldn't say they've missed it, but I think it's gotten overshadowed by the whole ownership discourse in many ways. So that's something I'm working on. I'm also trying to look at demolitions. And this is something before all these demolitions happened. Demolitions is something that I've been trying to work on for a while. And it's stemming from my PhD thesis. Because you do encounter demolitions in your when you work around cities. But then these demolitions can take very different forms, right? They're not always eventful. They could be, they're again bureaucratic exercises. So that's what I was interested in. But now that all these eventful demolitions have happened, I also cannot ignore that. So I'm still trying to juggle both these kinds of demolitions. One, a very bureaucratic one, which is again driven by registers and notes and so on and so forth. And on the other, this very eventful one where which is then exemplified by the image of a bulldozer, right? So those are two things I'm sort of working on at this point. Hope to get them out soon.
Thank you, Sushmita, for coming to NBN South Asia and talking to us about your work. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Arunik. This was a real, real pleasure, and we should talk more.
Yes, absolutely.